Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Cecilia Helena Payne, Annie Jump Cannon, and Wilhelmina Fleming made their start in the field of astronomy at the Harvard College Observatory in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Their backgrounds were diverse. Fleming had worked as a maid, Cannon was a Radcliffe astronomy student, and Payne was passionate about astronomy, but as a woman, there was little hope for employment in the field in her native Britain. The three were part of an unusual and largely unsung group employed at the observatory, doing what was at the time deemed women's work, toiling as human computers, or studying, deciphering, and classifying photographic images of the stars on tens of thousands of special glass plates. Some extraordinary scientific discoveries came of these efforts, and while a number of the women won acclaim in scientific circles, you might be hard-pressed to find their names in the standard high school textbook. Well, Dava Sobel brings their story to life in her new book, The Glass Universe: How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And she joins us this hour in studio of Radio Times. So nice to have you here, Dava.
I'm happy to be here.
You set the scene for this book in your preface. And if you could just read for us the opening paragraph, please.
I'd be happy to. A little piece of heaven. That was one way to look at this sheet of glass propped up in front of her. It measured about the same dimensions as a picture frame, 8 inches by 10, and no thicker than a window pane. It was coated on one side with a fine layer of photographic emulsion, which now held several thousand stars fixed in place, like tiny insects trapped in amber. One of the men had stood outside all night, guiding the telescope to capture this image, along with another dozen in the pile of glass plates that awaited her when she reached the observatory at 9 a.m. Warm and dry indoors, in her long woolen dress, she threaded her way among the stars. She ascertained their positions on the dome of the sky, gauged their relative brightness, studied their light for changes over time, extracted clues to their chemical content, and occasionally made a discovery that got touted in the press. Seated all around her, another 20 women did the same.
So this is the late 19th century, early 20th century, a scene from inside a room at the Harvard College Observatory. And as you write, Harvard is a male bastion at the time. And yet something truly exceptional for the times is beginning to happen at this scientific institution. Give us an overview, if you would.
I think the real reason so many women found a place there was that the observatory was separate from the university. And so the very forward-thinking, broad-minded director had license, his own license, to hire women.
And this is Edward Pickering?
Edward Pickering. Mm-hmm. And he was unusual for the time in that way. He was also a major proponent of higher education for women, which was very controversial in the late 19th century. In fact, some people thought that college was bad for girls and would even negatively influence their ability to have children.
Really?
Yeah, if you can believe that. But he didn't believe it. And he not only hired women, but he also opened the way for women to work on a volunteer basis. If they had studied astronomy in school and owned a telescope, they could make their own observations and send those in to the Harvard Observatory, where they would be collated with material produced there at Harvard and published.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Pickering, you write let me find this quote here. You quote him as saying, "The criticism is often made by the opponents of higher education of women that while they are capable of following others as far as men can, they originate almost nothing, so that human knowledge is not advanced by their work." And he goes on to say, "This reproach would be well answered could we point to a long series of such observations as are detailed below made by women observers. If women weren't originating anything, perhaps it's because there was very little opportunity to do so."
Perhaps. Yeah. But he didn't fight that battle. He just said, "Here's the work. Let's do it."
Yeah. At the same time, this work was considered to be women's work. what were the men doing? They were outside actually peering through the telescope.
They were outside, exactly. And when Pickering took over, which was the late 1870s, it really would have been unseemly to have women out there through the night with the men. And there was also some concern that the dark, the cold, the difficult position, sometimes you have to physically contort your body to be in at the telescope. So women weren't doing that. But by 1896, when Annie Jump Cannon came, she had so much practical experience that she was allowed to make observations from the very start of her time there.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Annie Jump Cannon.
I love her name. It's so active. And she was active. So she had been a Wellesley College student. She had completed her education at Wellesley and gone home to Delaware, where she was tutoring students in history and math, having a quiet life with her family. Her father was a state senator. And her mother had, in fact, gotten her excited about astronomy in childhood, taught her all the constellations and took her up to the roof of the house to look at the stars. So she had that in her background. And then at her mother's death, she felt completely lost, but went back to school, went back to assist at Wellesley in the lab where she had studied, and then from there on to Harvard and a place in the observatory where she stayed for the rest of her life, happily.
Well, in doing the research for this book, you use personal effects like letters and diaries to help shape the story.
And distinguish among the women, because there are quite a few women. And
how many
women? I was
women?
Really hoping to be able to get at their voices, and that was one of the most gratifying parts of the research.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Annie Jump Cannon's voice, and you do include an excerpt from one of her diaries, which is really affecting. You referred just a moment ago, David, to the death of her mother, and she was so close to her mom.
Yes.
If you could read this excerpt, and I think we're going to page 74 here.
Yes. I'm still here in my little room, surrounded by my memories. She wrote in her diary on March 4th, 1894, nearly 3 months after the funeral of Mary Elizabeth Jump Cannon. My mother is ever before me. I can see how people lose their minds, for I believe I shall if I am not aroused by something. She was mine and always will be my most precious mother. 12 weeks ago tonight, she was downstairs in the spare room, and was more worried about my taking a nap on my couch without covering than about herself. She said she knew I was going to be sick, for I looked so. And here I am, after 12 weeks of agony such as I shall never have to pass through again. Here I am, well. My constitution will carry me through many weary years. Yet may I be led into a useful, busy life. I am not afraid of work. I long for it. What can it be?
So Annie Jump Cannon's heart is on the page. And you, well, first of all, how did you find this material? And when you first read it, what was your reaction?
I had been told that Miss Cannon's diaries were in the Harvard archives. So I went to the archives and requested them. That's another just very gratifying thing, that all you have to do is be interested in something, and these materials are open to you. It's one of the great privileges we have, just as private citizens.
And again, there was so much that was personal in this diary, so
yes.
When you were looking through it...
Well, the diary turned out to be two cartons full of diaries. Hmm. She was a lifelong diarist and was still making notations till the weeks before she died. And so when I opened those boxes and saw all of the books, some of them very girlish with the leather covers and locks, others quite businesslike, 5-year diaries where you don't get more than a paragraph a day. And then I had to deal with her terrible handwriting, but I got the hang of it. And this passage I just read was one of the most personal. Once she got happy at Harvard, she often wrote about her work or about the other ladies, maybe how she had them all over to tea. But this was revelatory of her family situation and her need to apply herself to something meaningful.
Was diary keeping common in those days?
It probably was, but it wasn't common among the other women. Mm. There's nothing comparable to Miss Cannon's diaries.
What did she achieve?
She created a classification system for the stars, which is still in use today. She was given complete freedom by the director to look at the patterns that the starlight made and set up categories according to patterns, even though nobody knew what the patterns signified at the time. I think that's another part of this story that just appeals to me so greatly, that at the beginning, nobody knew what the stars were made of. Nobody knew what made them shine, or even how far away they were, why they were different brightnesses. Everything was a mystery. And over a relatively small number of decades, all the mysteries were solved.
In large part because of the work these women did at the Harvard Observatory.
Yes, and certainly by many other people as well.
Sure.
It was a grand international cooperative effort, but they were in the thick of it.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, you know, many of them stayed there for what, the rest of their lives?
Yes, it was unusual. No, you, at the
most
beginning, if you were married to the job, if you got married, you had to leave. And later that changed. By the 1920s, 1930s, it didn't seem so unusual anymore for a woman to get married and keep working.
Well, the Harvard College Observatory was kind of the poor sister over at the university, wasn't it? It
didn't have a whole lot of money from the university.
Yes. And then along comes there were a couple of women who were patrons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Heiresses who took a real interest in astronomy.
Let's talk about Anna Palma Draper. Who was she?
She was the daughter of a wealthy real estate magnate. And she married a doctor, Dr. Henry Draper, who, although he was a medical doctor, was passionate about astronomy and trained her to be his assistant. So in their marriage, they were doing really cutting-edge astronomy because they were completely independent, not affiliated with an observatory, and with lots of money available to them to pursue any path.
And we'll talk about that some more in just a moment on Radio Times. Our guest is Dava Sobel, who is author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And lines are open at 888-477-9499. We'll talk about it some more here on Radio Times in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are joined this hour by Dava Sobel, who is the author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And as always, if you'd like to join us in this conversation, feel free to give us a call at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet, works as well, at WHYY Radio Times. And Dava, going into the break, we were talking about Anna Palmer Draper and her husband, Henry Draper.
Right.
And they are both, Henry Draper is a scientist. He's an award-winning scientist. He is, their mission is focused on astronomy. And why don't you take it from here? He passes away.
Right. He was a pioneer also in photography and one of the first to really bring photography into astronomy. And just when they had settled their affairs, he was going to give up teaching and focus completely on astronomy. He died. And she was determined to have his name live on and to see this dream realized. And for a while, she tried to find assistants who could help her do the work. But then She instead gave a fortune to Harvard so that Edward Pickering could do the work with her money to buy instruments and hire people to do it. And all she asked in return was that the project be named for her husband, which Harvard was only too happy to do.
I'm sure.
And it is known as the Henry Draper Memorial.
So is it safe to say then that without benefactresses like Anna Palma Draper, this work might not have happened?
It is safe to say that. Yeah. Or it would have happened somewhere else, or it would have happened at a slower pace. But Pickering was very open to the idea of photography. Some astronomers didn't trust it.
Really?
You know, what shows up on these photographic plates? Can you really trust what you're seeing? Is it a speck of dust? What is it? But he experimented with it and was convinced that this was the future.
And again, give us a sense of, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but when one of these women was looking at a plate, what would the layman see on this plate, and what would they see?
Well, the layman might see a lot of pepper that had been spilled on a piece of glass. Mm. These are negative images, so the stars look black on white. And some of the images look like tiny ribbons, because they're all black and white. But in many of the photographs, a prism is introduced that splits the starlight. So the stars don't show up as dots. They show up as strips or spectra, mm-hmm. which is their light passed through the prism. And each spectra contained a pattern. And those patterns would be the ones Mrs. Cannon would be examining and determining almost at a glance which category each one fell into. So a given plate might contain several thousand stars. Other women might be looking at plates taken at of the same part of the sky at different times and trying to see how the brightness of the stars had changed from one image to the other. Not for everyone.
Yeah. Painstaking
work. And there was some sense that women were better suited to that. Because they are skilled, perhaps naturally skilled at pattern recognition, and have a greater capacity for close work, even tedium. But the male astronomers, too, had a great amount of tedium in their work, and they would have been the first to admit that. What showed up on the plates was more detailed than what could be seen through the telescope, because these were long exposures. So light could accumulate over time.
When you say a long exposure,
an hour, two hours, which involved tracking, having the telescope track so that it counteracts the motion of the Earth.
Yeah.
And the director often said that a magnifying glass will show more in a photograph than a powerful telescope will show in the sky.
What were they paid for this work?
Oh, 25 cents an hour,
maybe 30 cents an hour. At the time, what was that considered to be?
Well, it was a living wage. It definitely was. It wasn't as much as the men earned. The very first women at the observatory didn't earn anything because they were the wives, sisters, daughters of the astronomers and just roped into doing what needed to be done. They were taught how to make the calculations.
Yeah. Let's get into another one of the women you profile in the book, Wilhelmina Fleming. We'd referenced her a little bit earlier in the show. She's the person who had been, doing the work of a maid when she was...
She was hired as a maid, but I think she went for that job only because she was in desperate straits. She was an immigrant, and her husband had disappeared on her, and she was pregnant. So any work would do. And the Pickerings immediately noticed how bright she was. She had been a teacher in Scotland and moved her over and put her to work in the observatory and then let her go home to Scotland to have the baby, which is what she wanted to do. And she was so grateful to Pickering that she named her baby Edward Charles Pickering Fleming. And she came back and got a full-time job. She had that promise waiting for her. So she did go back and spent the rest of her life working at the observatory and became the first woman to have a university title at Harvard. Mm. She became the curator of astronomical photographs.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too. As you mentioned, she's a single mother.
Mm-hmm.
And as the curator, she had one day of rest from the observatory.
Just Sunday, right.
Which was Sunday, although she was also doing family work
right.
on that day.
Right.
And you include a quote from her. Alas, how matter of fact and different from the Sunday morning duties of other officers of the university. Meaning?
Right. Yeah, because she...
Her male counterparts.
Name, exactly.
Yeah.
And her name was in the university catalog.
Yeah.
So that's what she's referring to.
Mm.
And yet, she managed to put her son through college. He went to MIT and became a mining engineer. So she was frugal and successful.
And let's talk about some of her discoveries as well.
She made numerous discoveries of novae. She too,
which is what?
An exploding star.
Mm.
And at the beginning, they didn't know what it was. They just knew that all of a sudden, looking at a photographic plate, there was a bright new something where nothing used to be. So it was called a nova. Nowadays, people know it's not really suddenly something out of nothing. There's a much dimmer star there. And it's usually two stars together. And there's an interaction between them that's causing this periodic flare-up.
Yeah.
So she discovered about 10 of those. And at that time, novae were so rare, so few were known, that the women would get a little badge, a little medal for discovering one. But she was, even before Annie Jump Cannon came, she was trusted with this classification challenge. And she classified 10,000 stars and did the first publication of the Henry Draper catalog. So...
Did she receive widespread recognition for
yes,
her contribution?
Yes, indeed she did. Pickering always named them, cited exactly what their contributions had been. He was very fair about that. He nominated her for a national award a couple of times. And she was inducted as a foreign associate member of the Royal Astronomical Society.
It wasn't always easy for her, though, because
no,
you mentioned a tangle that she had with, what was it, who was it, Seth Carlo Chandler?
Well, there was always some sense that, again, these photographs were not to be trusted. So she had made numerous discoveries of variable stars, stars that changed their brightness over time. And Seth Carlo Chandler was an expert on those stars, very interested in them, but he made his discoveries through the telescope by his own practiced, experienced eye. And so he was not willing to believe her discoveries. And when he created his catalogs, he would always refer to her discoveries as provisional, you know, not really going along with the discoveries.
But she was eventually vindicated.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just fascinating, isn't it, to think that there is so much that can be discovered from one glass photographic plate.
Although they had hundreds of
thousands. Well, hundreds of thousands, yeah. Okay. But, I mean, even looking at one, just really being able to make determinations
about anything. Yeah. And then she was also responsible for just the curating of them. How do you organize them? How do you prepare them? Pickering used to say that each one was like a book, and it contained thousands of pages of information. So he needed people to read them, and he needed them to be stored the way books are stored in a library, so you know exactly where everything is, and you can go to the volume you need to consult it whenever necessary.
And how many of these plates are there total today at Harvard?
About 500,000.
Half a million.
And they are all still in the special building that Pickering insisted on creating for them, because the original observatory was a wooden structure. And as soon as he had a critical mass of plates, he began agitating for a brick building.
So a wooden
fire,
structure,
the worry
could have gone
of fire,
up, and all that work would have been gone.
Right, and it was irreplaceable. Even then, it gets only more valuable as time goes by because it preserves a century of the sky. And then they also had a satellite observatory in the southern hemisphere, where another heiress came in and said, you need $50,000 to build a telescope? Let me write you a check. Yeah, that was Catherine Wolfe Bruce.
And just kind of, she was interested in the work.
She got really interested. She was in her 70s, but just thought this was the most fascinating thing. Mm-hmm. And she kept up a close correspondence with Pickering. He would send her the observatory's publications and visit her in New York. Yeah. They had a very
fortunate for the observatory. Yeah. And
he was very charming.
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Pickering was.
Yes, he was indeed very charming. Yeah.
I'd like to get to the Southern Observatory and actually talk about this 24-inch telescope that he wanted for the observatory and how the lenses were put together. But first, we've got some telephone calls. So let's get to David in Hopewell, New Jersey. Welcome to Radio Times, David.
Yes, good morning, ladies. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. How are you?
Very good. I'm just so happy to hear that more research is being done for that research as far as the early 20th century with women that have their heart and soul into things. And she sure didn't seem like she was going to be held back. I was just curious, was anyone ever trying to do anything like usurp her? Any type of her information or anything? Was any underhanded things ever done to her?
So, David, are you talking about Annie Jump Cannon?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, that's an interesting question,
David, because
again, at the time, you know, many people, many in the scientific community really didn't recognize the women's work that was happening at the time. So as some of these women advanced in the work, were there efforts to kind of circumvent? I mean, we talked about that a little bit with Seth Carlo Chandler. But
I'm happy to say that the question really surprised me because especially with Miss Cannon, she seems not to have encountered any foul play of any kind. She, her background, her command of the subject was impeccable, and her personality seems to have been so winning. She, in addition to her diaries, all her correspondence survives. So it's clear that she was in correspondence with astronomers all over the world who were doing this kind of work or who needed information on her work even before it was published. And they would write to her to say, do you know anything yet about this particular star? And she would write back, yes, I know it's this category, and share the information. And then there were several astronomers she had ongoing correspondence with. And with all of those, she wound up also having a correspondence relationship with their children. Even if the children were very young, she would start by sending them little notes and little gifts. And then years later, there'd be a wedding invitation. And the grown children would carry on the correspondence even after their parents died.
And she was
everybody's Aunt Nan.
Yeah. And passionate about her work.
And how she had time to do all of that and do her work.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times.
Sure. And did you say what age Henry Draper passed?
Draper was 45 when he died.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the call into Radio Times. So, okay, Dave, let's get to the 24-inch telescope that Edward Pickering wants to have built for the Harvard Observatory that's in the Southern Hemisphere, which is in Peru.
Peru, right. He had to send someone down there to explore and find a place and Yeah.
And the story of the lens disc, and we have about a minute or so before you have to get to the break. It's really fascinating. The discs, I guess, are ordered from an Edouard Mantois in Paris.
In Paris, right.
And if you could take a moment just to read, you know, as these lens discs finally arrive, and actually you reference Antonia Mori. We'll try to get to her too, but she's about ready to leave, you know, at least temporarily from the observatory. But anyway, if you could just take a quick look at that paragraph for us and give us a sense of what
50?
Page 50, yeah, a sense of what these lens discs are all about.
Miss Mori's departure at the start of 1892 coincided with the long-awaited arrival from France of the Bruce Telescope's glass discs, two of flint and two of crown, each 2 feet in diameter by 3 inches thick, weighing in the neighborhood of 90 pounds and rimmed in a metal hoop. The flawless purity of the glass rendered the discs invisible, and therein lay their beauty. Pickering immediately consigned them to the Clarks for the all-important grinding and polishing. He expected the transformation of the discs into the four-element portrait lens to take at least 6 months of long days on the Clarks' steam-powered lathe. First, the glasses would be abraded with rough sand, then by ever finer rouge powders, until they assumed the desired curvature.
Yeah. An intricate process, and it took years for these lenses to actually get to an impatient observatory the southern hemisphere.
Well, partly because the glazier was doing other work and didn't even get to them for many months.
Our guest this hour is Dava Sobel. She is author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And what we're doing this hour is we're focusing on this unusual story that Dava tells in her book about a group of women at the Harvard Observatory who worked as computers. We'll get into that in a moment. And also they helped really to map the stars. Stay with us for more of Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and Dava Sobel, a former New York Times science reporter, is here with us in studio. She is author of the new book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And a lot of this work happened in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, an unusual and largely unsung band of women. And we're profiling some of them this hour of Radio Times. Let's get to Cecilia Helena Payne. She comes to Cambridge back in the early 1920s from Cambridge, England. And she had faced, as you write, some Victorian strictures as a child.
Yes, just from the era and from her family. So when she got to Harvard and found nobody would make her clock in at a certain hour, if she wanted to work all night at the observatory, she could. And that's what she did. She just loved having that American style freedom.
And fortunately for the world of astronomy, she had so much potential that the director at the time of the observatory, Harlow Shapley, urged her to take her research beyond her master's and through to a doctorate. And that was that done at the time?
No.
And for a woman.
And Shapley had instituted the program of graduate education in astronomy at Harvard. There wasn't one in Pickering's time. But when Shapley took over in 1921, that was paramount for him. And because of the history, because of the women there, and yet another heiress who had set up fellowships for women to come and work in the observatory, the only money he had to support graduate students were fellowships for women. So all the early graduate students in astronomy at Harvard were women. And Cecilia Payne earned the first Harvard PhD in astronomy.
She was, during the journey, though, she was, it seems a little bit uncertain about what she would be able to perhaps achieve as a woman. You write that as she was about to submit a report on the spectra of the hottest stars to the journal Nature under the name C.H. Payne, but Shapley challenges her on this in the way she's going to submit it, at least with the name.
Are you ashamed of being a woman? Yeah. So she changed. She wrote out her name.
Let's talk about changing gender roles at the time. I mean, some of the women at the observatory seemed to revel as well in what was considered to be feminine at the time. And in reading your book, I seem to get just perhaps a mixed sentiment from Cecilia Payne. She pictured herself a rebel against the feminine role, as you write, but she also didn't mind being treated as different, and you quote her as saying, of course women are different from men. Their whole outlook and approach are testimony to it. And this is a woman, as we'll learn in a moment, who goes on to accomplish an extraordinary amount in her field. What might she have been referring to here, Deva?
She very much liked doing what she called the feminine things, like cooking, sewing. And she said, when you're working on a project for years, some astronomy problem, it is a great pleasure to turn out a masterpiece in the kitchen in a couple of hours. So she had that balance always. Yeah. And she went on to marry and have three children, and her daughter remembers how their clothes were homemade, and yet her mother continued to have a distinguished career in astronomy and be world famous.
And again, you really delve into the personal side of the history of these women. Cecilia Payne loses a very close friend at the observatory and embarks on a journey to visit the observatories of Northern Europe, and she ends up at a meeting in Germany when a young stranger seats himself next to her. Now, you can get into that a little bit, but I love, you know, again, one of these quotes that you have in the book here, this young stranger who knows who she is thinks she was supposed to be a lot older than
she is. Right, he's expecting her to be the age of Miss Cannon.
And you write, her youth and bearing put him in mind of, quote, a ripe peach left alone on a tree, darkened, wrinkled a little outside, but the more delicious inside.
Well, that was the man she married, and you can see why.
But it's a kind of a neat adventure that involves, the coming of the war and this young man who is trying to fight.
Yes, they lived through all sorts of things. And during the wars, both World War I and World War II, the astronomers' knowledge became very useful to the government, especially World War II. Even Shapley's wife was working for the Navy, calculating ballistics trajectories. So very little went on, very little astronomy went on at the observatory because so many of the staff left to do war work.
Yeah. And again, with us, we talked a little bit about Annie Jump Cannon and the research you did to find out really who she was. How about Cecilia Payne? What was that journey like for you? What did you use to discover aspects of her life?
Well, she's written her autobiography, so that was a big help. And she also wrote her doctoral dissertation, which is an exemplary dissertation because she made a major discovery in it. She was calculating the relative percentages of different elements in the stars, and she kept coming up against hydrogen being about a million times more prevalent than anything else, which seemed crazy. Nobody was expecting that. And so she was advised by Shapley and by another expert to tone that down a bit. And she said that she had this result. It's probably a spurious result. Nevertheless, she's reporting it. And it took only 4 years for the whole astronomy community to come around because of other research. I mean, people looked into what she did.
So she was vindicated.
Because her work was so careful and beautiful that you couldn't just laugh off that result. You had to see why it was coming up, and it turns out it was coming up because it was, in fact, real. Now we know that stars consist mainly of hydrogen.
So Cecilia Payne eventually makes a transition from a postdoctoral fellow to full-fledged astronomer, and Harlow Shapley, who's the director of the observatory, thinks she deserves an academic position at Harvard, but the president pushes back.
There's a president in place who doesn't like the idea of women. He's even changed what was Mrs. Fleming's title is no longer a university title. It's been demoted to astronomy department business.
And is this after the 19th Amendment was ratified?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Win some, you lose some.
Well, but Cecilia Payne goes on to...
Oh, yes. She did go on to become a full professor, to be the first woman promoted to a tenured professorship from within the ranks of the university. And she was, for a while, the chair of the astronomy department.
But that was not something that I think she relished.
She didn't really
once
like,
she
who
got
wants
into
to be
it?
The department chair? It's really, it's just...
Keep you away from the real work.
From the real work, mm-hmm. Right.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Kimberton, Pennsylvania. And James is in Kimberton. And welcome to Radio Times, James.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to bring forth the work of a Philadelphian woman, Vera Rubin.
Yes.
Philadelphia. And she has caused quite the revolution in astronomy, astrophysics, and physics itself. It's where the idea of dark energy and dark matter comes from, this woman. And through that, she's the some of the first to put the first substantial questioning of the Big Bang Theory. I've been doing a lot to advance women in science, and over the last couple of years, it's been a huge, huge, wonderful surprise to see that, of all places, women advancing into leadership roles, it is science. I'm sure there's plenty yet to be done, but in our lifetimes, this is a grand, grand victory for women advancing into leadership roles. Yeah. And I thank you for your work.
Oh, we appreciate the call to our Radio Times, James.
Yeah, Vera Rubin is a hero of mine. I've had the pleasure of meeting her a few times because she's a modern astronomer. She's elderly now, not working anymore. But she chose to go to Vassar College because she knew that Mariah Mitchell, who was the first American woman to become famous in astronomy, had taught at Vassar in the 1800s. But that was enough for Vera. She was Vera Cooper then. Yeah. She went to Vassar. And her studies of the rotations of galaxies gave the first evidence of dark matter.
So what drew you to this story, Deva? Of the women at the Harvard Observatory.
I first heard about Henrietta Leavitt, someone we've not mentioned yet.
Yes.
More than 20 years ago, I was interviewing astronomer Wendy Friedman about her work with the Hubble telescope, and she mentioned Henrietta Leavitt's discovery as something that was pivotal.
Tell us a bit about Henrietta.
So Henrietta had gone to Oberlin and then Radcliffe and came to work at the observatory, and she was looking mostly at variable stars, discovering new ones, noticing how they changed over time. And in a particular group of stars that's visible only from the southern hemisphere, so she had photographs from the Bruce telescope in Peru, and she made an observation that this certain class of variable stars, the brighter the star, the longer it took to cycle through its changes. And she made such careful records of a number of these stars that it became possible to calibrate the brightness, so that if you discovered one of those stars that was a certain period of time but looked dimmer, mm-hmm. than the ones... I'm sorry, I'm not explaining this well.
Well, you know, it's so complex.
You kind of need to
stuff.
Have it on the page and not just say it quickly in an answer. But suffice it to say that by looking at the periods and the brightness of the stars, she provided a basis for determining distances in space.
Okay.
So two stars that had the same period and one looked much dimmer than the other, mm-hmm. you knew it was much farther away.
Got
and
it.
You could calibrate it.
Okay.
And with that information, the size of the Milky Way was determined.
Really?
Hubble was able to use that to show that there were other galaxies beyond the Milky Way. For a long time, people argued that. Was it just the one that was the sum total of the universe, or were there many others? And using Ms. Leavitt's stars, indeed, there were others.
Is that Leavitt's Law?
That is Leavitt's Law.
Oh, okay.
It's now called Leavitt's Law. It wasn't called that in her time.
So,
and also the fact that the universe is expanding. Same basic yardstick.
And
led
this is
to that discovery.
All due to the work that Henrietta Leavitt started
yes.
at the Harvard Observatory.
Yes.
So you become aware of Henrietta Leavitt and her work. And is this then when you really fully become aware of the women who, you know,
right,
over
because
the
Right, because when I went to learn more about her, I discovered that she was in a room full of women, which seemed really odd. At that time and place.
Were the quarters close? Were they sitting
yes.
right on top of each other?
Well, not on top of each other, but they were certainly in a room. Later they had individual offices, but at the beginning, everybody was in the computing room.
Yeah. So what is it about? Do you consider yourself to be a science writer? David?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And is this something, I mean, are you working on another project?
No. Not finished with these women.
Oh, really?
More material has turned up at the observatory. And
where and what?
Just, you know, things lying around in boxes and repositories. So, in fact, there's a lot of opportunity for people to volunteer on crowdsourcing platforms to look at this material and input it so that it can be generally accessible. Mm. While people are welcome to go to the archives and use them, the reading room's open only a few hours a day, 5 days a week. If material were available online, there would be greater access.
Am I hearing possibly that there might be a volume two?
I call it volume two. I don't think it will take the form of a book.
Yeah.
But Carl Sagan was a huge influence on me. That was really what made me focus on astronomy as opposed to science writing in general. And a few years ago, his Cosmos series was remade
sure.
by the original writers, but with Neil Tyson in the host role,
mm-hmm.
and there was an episode about the Harvard women. And that has really caught on. Several young playwrights have picked them up. A young artist I know is doing an art installation where she's actually painting some of the plates, huge paintings, 6 feet by 6 feet, that show the plates for the artwork some of them really are.
Yeah. It kind of makes you wonder who else might be out there.
Undiscovered.
Undiscovered,
yeah.
Yes, in history
well,
of various
I'm happy to say, I want to say again that the women really were appreciated in their own day.
Hmm.
This is not a chip on the shoulder story. It's just a forgotten story.
Well, sometimes it seems as if it's parsed that way if you read articles.
It is,
you know,
it
they
is.
Were not, they were doing quote unquote women's work. They weren't paid very much and they had to struggle yeah. some of them for recognition. But you say
yeah,
but not necessarily.
They were given an extraordinary opportunity and they ran with it and they traveled to scientific meetings in Europe. They did it all.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dava Sobel, it was such a pleasure to have you here with us for Radio Times.
Thank you. It was fun.
Her newest book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And Dava Sobel will be appearing tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia at 7:30. And this reminder, check out our Facebook page and also our podcast. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.